and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein, coming to you from Des Moines, Iowa.
Wait, let's get specific, Rick. You're in Des Moines. You were there, of course, for the Democratic debate. But you're on your way back to Washington, right? Because we have a lot that's going on here.
I know. I'm missing all the big news, like all these senators. This was the last Democratic debate, and some of these candidates were...
Wait, the last before they start voting.
Before the actual voting starts. But now impeachment is the big story. So all these senators headed back to Washington as well. That's where the split screen is going to play out. Some campaigns happy about this, some not so much. But it's pretty much all over but the caucusing at this point. It's hard to see a major event changing things in this presidential race, except we have all these major events that happen in Washington just about every day.
Wait. So where are you?
I am at the Hilton Hotel in downtown Des Moines.
So when's your flight? You're leaving soon?
Yeah, about an hour, hour and a half. I think half of Washington will be back on it because everyone needs to get back.
I'm just wondering if you're going to have any candidates on on your flight. You know, get a strategic middle seat. You could have another follow-on debate sandwiched between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. So, look, there is a lot going on, and we're going to have a major guest in the second half of this podcast. Trent Lott, who was the Republican leader during the last impeachment trial, has some very interesting observations and experiences. He also, Rick, I don't know if you realize this, that Lott was actually on the committee, the House committee, during the Nixon impeachment. He was the youngest member of that committee. So a very unique perspective. We're going to be talking to him. But I got you on the ground in Iowa. And I wanted, you know, I watched the debate, of course. I wasn't out there with you. I watched it from back here. And I got to say, you know, we were all waiting for that big moment where Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would confront each other over what was said or not said, you know, when Elizabeth Warren was exploring her possible run for the president. Did Bernie Sanders say that a woman couldn't be elected? And it was fascinating. I watched the debate. I think we were almost at the halfway point before that question came up.
Yeah, and I'll tell you who couldn't have been happier about that. Bernie Sanders, but also Elizabeth Warren. This was one of the weirdest stories that I can recall dropping on debate eve, because the Warren folks were saying consistently, we didn't want this out there. Obviously, it was their team, members of their team, that were behind this leak and confirming this story for CNN on the eve of the CNN debate. Her strategy coming into the debate was to be the unifier, to be the big picture person that could be the second choice of caucus goers or people that are undecided, to say, I'm going to be bigger than the rest of this field. This didn't fit with that message. So all of the Warren team that we were talking to on the ground and going into the debate were saying, de-escalate, de-escalate, de-escalate. And yeah, when she had the opportunity, she didn't back down, but she also didn't go in for the kill against Bernie.
And let's be clear, this is a big allegation. I mean, the idea that Bernie Sanders would tell Elizabeth Warren in a private conversation that a woman can't be elected president, I mean, that's a big deal. I mean...
And to unpack that, John, it's a big deal if you believe that he said it, or even if you're skeptical of it, for two reasons. One is there's obvious sexism in that comment, although Bernie denies it. The other is there are so many lingering hurt feelings and anger among Democrats that supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 that anything involving Bernie kind of goes viral in those circles. And it tapped into, I think, a lot of that resentment, and maybe even to caucus goers who are worried about Bernie or angry about Bernie and worried that Elizabeth Warren isn't willing to stand up to him. This put that maybe just a little bit to rest. So I think there could have been a couple of levels to the strategery around putting this out there.
That's a great point. I have talked to Democrats over the last 3 years or so who have blamed Hillary Clinton's defeat and Donald Trump's victory on the Russians. I have heard Jim Comey blamed for it. I have heard the campaigns, you know, the Clinton campaign's decisions, particularly not, you know, engaging, sufficiently Wisconsin, Michigan, blamed for it. But I have heard almost as much as all of that bitter feelings to this day of supporters of Hillary Clinton, including people involved in the campaign, who give Bernie Sanders a lot of the blame for her defeat in the general election because of the bitterness of that primary, even the gamesmanship at the convention itself. So that's an excellent point. But let's Let's play a little bit of the back and forth. When they finally got to this subject during the debate, the question was first posed to Bernie Sanders, and this is what he had to say.
Well, as a matter of fact, I didn't say it. And I don't want to waste a whole lot of time on this because this is what Donald Trump and maybe some of the media want. Anybody knows me knows that it's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States. Go to YouTube today. There's a video of me 30 years ago talking about how a woman could become president of the United States. In 2015, I deferred, in fact, to Senator Warren. There was a movement to draft Senator Warren to run for president. And you know what? I said, stayed back. Senator Warren decided not to run, and I did run afterwards.
Well, you know, that's a pretty emphatic denial that, you know, from Bernie Sanders that he ever said that. So the obvious question to Elizabeth Warren is Bernie lying? Did he actually say it? Is he not telling the truth about it? Now, what happened when Elizabeth Warren was asked that direct question, Rick?
Well, she didn't get asked that direct question quite.
Wait a minute. She didn't get asked that question?
Wasn't quite there. It wasn't quite there. And we should play it. We should play it out. Let's listen to that.
You're saying that you never told Senator Warren that a woman could not win the election.
That is correct.
Senator Warren, what did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
I disagreed. Bernie is my friend, and I am not here to try to fight with Bernie. But look, this question about whether or not a woman can be president has been raised, and it's time for us to attack it head on. And I think the best way to talk about who can win is by looking at people's winning record. So, can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women, Amy and me.
So to be clear, John, we haven't heard in Elizabeth Warren's own voice what actually was said. She'll be asked about that. She will have to get into that back and forth. But it was an off-ramp for her to turn the argument in a different direction rather than making it about Bernie Sanders. And the big anticipated clash between these two progressive titans didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
But it was strange that the question was not asked. So the question, you know, instead of being, is Bernie telling the truth, did he actually say that? You know, it's like, why was he wrong when he said it? So it's still hanging out there. Is Elizabeth Warren calling Bernie Sanders a liar about this? At any rate, Mary Alice Parks, our colleague, has said that because the debate didn't start out in that way, it started out on issues of foreign policy. The first question from Wolf Blitzer was really an open ended. Why are you qualified to be commander in chief? Question that went to Bernie Sanders and variations to the others. It focused on national security, foreign policy. In Mary Alice's analysis, this was good for Mayor Pete, who was able to answer questions on that and really seemed like he was in full command of what he was talking about, was able to play into his own military experience and look much steadier on those questions than you might expect, a mayor of a mid-sized city. Mayor Pete seemed like somebody that knew exactly what he was talking about and got a chance to shine in the beginning of that debate. What's your take on that?
I think that's right, and I think it also tracks with the enthusiasm on the ground. People that are into Mayor Pete are really into Mayor Pete here in Iowa. They are very excited about this candidacy. There is a true enthusiasm gap that you see between his candidacy and particularly, I would say, Joe Biden's candidacy, even though Biden continues to poll very strong. There's some concern among Pete supporters that maybe he peaked a little too early, and that as people focus in, it begins to fade a little bit. I'll tell you, John, I got a chance to meet in the hotel here Mayor Pete's mom right after the debate.
Oh.
The conversation was off the record, but I don't think I'm violating.
She's endorsing him?
I would just say she thinks that her son did a fabulous job on that stage. She was very proud of
him. This is the kind of reporting, Rick.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. And again, I'm being careful on the sourcing on this, but I think Mayor Pete's mom is on board. And she goes to all debates, which I think is kind of cool.
So we've talked about this. We've had four different front runners at different times in Iowa. Literally, the Des Moines Register poll, the last four polls, correct, has had four different
front runners. Yeah.
So the most recent is Bernie Sanders. Before we move on, Rick, can you just tell me who's going to win the Iowa caucuses on February 3rd?
The connection's getting a little fuzzy here. I don't know what's going on. I'll tell you this: I read into the lack of big blows at the debate as a sign that all four front runners think they have a path to win, and they think that going negative has more of a negative impact on them. And there's been a history of that in this campaign. You got to be careful when you try to take someone down. There's a history here in Iowa. A lot of people remember the mutually assured destruction of Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean back in 2004.
Yep.
So becoming a heat-seeking missile to take someone down in the run-up to the caucuses has a tendency to backfire. So we may get a little more Iowa nice before it's done.
So the story may be coming out, depending on how close this all looks, will be if one of those four that has been a front runner, Biden, Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, if one of those four does not come in the top four, that could be a death blow.
Yeah, if any of those four don't, I think it would be bad. And Amy Klobuchar, who also had a very strong night, is the most likely to crack that top tier.
Okay, so Rick, we as we mentioned, it's been a big day here in Washington. We heard from Nancy Pelosi. She has announced the seven impeachment managers for the Democrats, handing over the articles of impeachment. We are on the cusp of a Senate trial for only a Senate impeachment trial of a president for only the third time in American history, and Pelosi laid down a marker as she announced this, which is basically, nobody really expects the Senate to vote to remove Donald Trump. But Pelosi said, in a way, that doesn't matter.
It's about the Constitution. It's about the Republic, if we can keep it. And they shouldn't be frivolous with the Constitution of the United States, even though the President of the United States has. The President is not above the law. He will be held accountable. He has been held accountable. He has been impeached. He's been impeached forever. They can never erase that.
So there you have. Impeachment is forever, Rick.
Yeah, and I read that in two different directions. One is the historical stain that she hopes that it leaves. The other piece of it is the signal that the House is not done. And we've seen some additional evidence begin to trickle out, even in the wake of the articles of impeachment, the announcement that the articles of impeachment are being transmitted. The possibility of reopening an investigation in another direction, maybe even more articles of impeachment, though I think that's pretty unlikely. But I think the way that the House Democrats are continuing to play this is to signal that, yeah, our work ends now, but don't take that as a signal that we're retreating in any way. And there is more that can come out there, and this will be a stain on your legacy and also something that overhangs your presidency forever.
And some of the new documentary evidence has been quite damning. The materials from Lev Parnas showing, clearly the effort to, on one hand, remove Ambassador Yovanovitch and to put pressure on Zelensky to open this investigation into Biden, into Burisma. But don't you get the sense that even if the Democrats uncovered hidden video of President Zelensky hanging from a ceiling, tied up and being prodded and poked and, denied of food and water by Rudy Giuliani himself in the basement of some torture chamber, you think it would affect the vote in the Senate?
No, I'm 67 votes, not happening. But the Democrats have moved the bar a bit to make it 51, and the 51 means that you have a right to call a witness, and additional information comes out, and maybe that changes the dynamic. I mean, look, I talked to a top Senate Democrat over the weekend about this. They're not under any illusions that they are going to get 67 votes and convict the president and remove him from office. That's just not happening. But they continue to think the process matters, and the way that they're trying to put the Senate itself on trial matters for political as well as broader structural reasons. You can't talk to a House Democrat these days and not without getting a quote from the founders,
which
Alexander
is interesting.
Hamilton and, yeah, and Benjamin Franklin. So a lot of constitution lessons that we're having here. They're thinking very broad and very big. And as we start to see Trump have to defend himself for the first time, it'll be interesting if they try to engage on the substance, or do they try to, as the House Republicans did, make it, the whole thing into being an illegitimate sham?
All right, Rick, I know you have a plane to catch, and we have waiting for us on the line, Senator Trent Lott. We are going to take a quick break, and we will see you when you get back to Washington, Rick.
Cool, thanks.
Welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are joined now by Senator Trent Lott, the former majority leader of the United States Senate, and somebody with a very unique perspective on this as the majority leader during the last impeachment trial of a president. And also, Senator Lott, you served on the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment proceedings for Richard Nixon.
Yes, that's true. I was a freshman congressman, 1973-74, 32 years old. I had no idea what I was wading into on that committee with 36 lawyers, but that was a difficult experience. So I sort of began my career in Congress with an impeachment proceeding, and then on the back end, I had to deal with the impeachment trial of William Jefferson Clinton. So I guess I've learned more about impeachment proceedings than anybody would ever really want to know.
And back in the Nixon impeachment, you voted in favor of one of the articles at committee.
Well, I voted against the articles. In fact, I argued successfully against one of the articles, but we did report out two other articles. I voted against both of them. But then when I was shown the smoking gun by a personal friend of mine from Mississippi that was working at that time in the White House, I did go to the floor of the House and announce that I would vote one article. A removal, which was the obstruction of justice charge.
So I want to get to your advice to the current leadership. But before we do, a little bit of history on the last Senate trial, which I covered. I was there every single day. I was hounding you in the corridors of the Senate for information. I sat in the Senate chamber for virtually every day of that trial. And there are a couple of things that stand out. And I've gone back and read through my journals from the time just because you forget about so much because so much has happened in the intervening couple of decades. But the end of that trial, there was a rather extraordinary moment where you and Senator Daschle, the Democratic leader at the time, both praised Justice Rehnquist for his for presiding over the trial, and were actually quite complimentary of each other for the fact that despite all the acrimony and all the bitterness that led up to that, you were able to lead what was seen by both sides as a fair impeachment process.
Right. Well, I did have a very good relationship with Tom Daschle, who was from South Dakota and the Democratic leader at the time. But remember, you know, the times were different. The media was different. Everything was different. But I think the fact that Tom and I had such a comfortable relationship and I could talk to him honestly and openly, and, you know, I trusted him. I think he felt the same way about me. In fact, the Sunday after the House had voted on Saturday for impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton, I called Tom and said, Tom, whether we like it or not, this thing is in our lap and we're going to have to comply with the Constitution, but I'd like for it to be done with decorum and civility and as bipartisan as possible. And so to get started, now why don't you pick one of your people and I'll send Slade Gordon from our side, who is a former attorney general from Washington State, and we'll see if they can write up a paper that would assist us in deciding how to proceed. And he agreed, and he sent Joe Lieberman. They came up with a very good proposal, but when I presented to the Republican conference, it really would have been over in a couple of weeks, and they said, oh, no, you're just trying to short-circuit this. That won't do. I had to go back to Tom and say, I can't sell it, so we're going to have to try to come up with something else. And that's when we went into the old Supreme Court chamber and came out with the Graham Kennedy proposal for the rules of how to proceed that passed 100-0. But I think, truly, my relationship with Tom was unique and made it possible for us to have the kind of constitutional process to consider the impeachment trial in the proper way.
You know, I remember, and I was in the outside the door of that closed meeting in the old Supreme Court chamber, the old Senate chamber, and it was the 100 senators, as I recall, no staff, right?
Right.
No staff, obviously no press, It was just the senators, and you emerged with that agreement on how to hold the trial. And as you point out, it was 100-0, and we remember that. But the other thing to remember is it was really acrimonious before you stepped into that chamber. There were a lot of the same disagreements we hear now. There were disagreements about witnesses. There were disagreements about how you had Democrats that wanted to stop the thing before it started, just like you have some Republicans now. I mean, it was not a given that you were going to come out with that with
no,
that agreement.
A lot of people forget that we had been fumbling around for, I don't know, a week or 10 days and couldn't get an agreement of how to proceed. And then somebody came up with this idea, let's go into the old Supreme Court chamber, just the senators, and let's talk it out among ourselves. And to prepare for that, I called Danny Akaka from Hawaii and asked him to open the session, asking God's guidance as we were trying to make some decisions. And then I called Bob Byrd and asked him to give us a brief tutorial on what the Constitution required. And he did. He did a great job, of course, but it wasn't that brief. But then I had Connie Mack, who's one of my closest allies from Florida, where I could watch him and communicate with him during the proceedings, and we started off with a discussion. And then Phil Graham got up and basically suggested how we could proceed, and then Kennedy spoke, and I realized that they were saying essentially the same thing. And I looked down at Connie. I said, I think they're saying the same thing. He said, yes. So I said, that's it. We'll go with the Graham-Kennedy proposal of how to go forward. And so I got Tom Daschle and said, you know, we need to go explain what just happened. We went up to the press gallery, where you probably were, to explain it. And on the way up there, he said, do you fully understand what we just agreed to? I said, no, but we got an agreement. So why don't you send a couple of people, and I'll send a couple of people into my conference room, and they'll write it up. So he sent Kennedy and Lieberman, and I sent Phil Graham and Slade Gordon, and they wrote up the proposal, and that was what we voted on. So it was a unique experience. And by the way, people forget that several nights, we had night sessions on the floor of the Senate without press, without staff, where we just talked among ourselves. And Tom and I have both talked about how different the tenor and the tone and, the communications were when it was just us talking among ourselves about how to get through that and get to a final conclusion.
And I want to get to the current trial, but the other thing you had going for you, so you had the unique relationship, and you guys fought, make no mistake, but you had a relationship with Senator Daschle, with the Democratic leader.
Right. I mean, we're fundamentally different. I mean, I was a Southern conservative Republican, and he was a Midwestern liberal Democrat. We philosophically, we had a lot of disagreements, but we had a personal respect. And, I made a point of trying to be helpful to the Democratic leader when I could, when it was something that was important to his state or his party, where we could have a bipartisan agreement. I think that's part of what we've lost now. I was out of the leadership for a while and came back in 2006, and I was shocked at how much harder it had gotten to get things done and how much meaner it had gotten. And I think we're still reaping that effect now.
Yeah, and the other thing you had is you mentioned Phil Graham and Ted Kennedy, and I mean, these were giants of the Senate. I mean, Ted Kennedy, the great liberal icon, Phil Graham, about as conservative a member of your conference as you had, and the idea that they could come to an agreement. And I look at it now, and look, these were, I don't want to like romanticize how wonderful and everybody got along back then, because you guys didn't. I mean, there were
we had some pretty serious fights.
You had some very serious fights. But
by the way, people forget that when Tom Daschle and I were in the leadership, they say, oh, well, it was so different, it was easy, y'all didn't have any problems. Hey, we had 9/11, we had the anthrax attack, we had the 50-50 Senate, and we had the impeachment trial of William Jefferson Clinton.
Yeah.
None of those were easy.
None of them. So now, looking to where we are now, there is no comparative relationship with Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, and frankly, there is no Ted Kennedy or Phil Graham, in the Senate right now. What is your advice, Ben, to McConnell, and has he sought your counsel on this?
Well, not exactly. You know, his chief of staff was my deputy chief of staff, Sharon Sunderstrom. I have talked a little bit to her, and my floor assistant, Elizabeth Ledsworth, and I worked up an hour counting what happened every day, every hour as we went forward. So I have made that available to the leadership. I did have a good long conversation with Senator Thune and his staff attorneys. So we talked a little bit, but not directly to Senator McConnell.
And so what would your advice be if he called you up right now?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, one of the things that Tom and I did, generally speaking, we didn't have separate press conferences. We basically tried to do joint press conferences, and we were restrained in you know, what we said to the press during the process of the impeachment proceedings with regard to Clinton. I think he's on the right track by saying, look, we got a template here. It was done with Clinton, and it was done successfully. I've even pointed out that it was quite different in the House Judiciary Committee, even though it was very difficult, of course. Chairman Rodino bent over backward to try to make it bipartisan. He was very considerate when I've tried to get recognition. In fact, I complained in one of the books that was written about it that the problem we had with the chairman, he gave us everything we asked for. So the tenor was very different. But,
that's,
you know,
the Nixon,
If I were going to make any suggestions to them, is you go forward the way we did for the first phase, hear from the managers, hear from the president's representatives, go to the question period with the senators, asking written questions through the chief justice, and then at that point you can decide what you want to do next. People forget that we had more than one vote on rules. We also had a vote on the Byrd motion to dismiss early on. We also had a vote toward the end on a Dianne Feinstein effort to censure. Mm-hmm. President Clinton. Now, the vote there was not just a 51 vote. It was a motion to suspend the rules, so it took two-thirds vote. So we had several votes along the way, which were not easy either, before we got to the vote on the final articles of impeachment.
There's been some discussion whether or not the Chief Justice who presides over it, Rehnquist, in the case of the Clinton trial, now it'll be John Roberts in the case of this trial, whether or not the Chief Justice as the presiding officer can cast a tie-breaking vote the way the Vice President does in normal session when the Vice President is the
right.
You know, presiding
well,
officer.
I believe that if they did have a vote other than on articles, that you know, they just required 51 votes. If there was a 50-50 tie, I think that the Chief Justice would have to break the tie, not the Vice President. However, I don't think that he or Senator McConnell or Senator Schumer would let it come to that. Somebody would change their vote, move around to not put the Chief Justice in that position. But again, I think that the example has been set by Chief Justice Rehnquist and how he handled the proceedings and how he was involved, that Chief Justice Roberts can hopefully repeat and implement. Now, well, I was fortunate that my sergeant-at-arms at the time for the Senate was Jim Ziegler, who was from my hometown, but he was a GW Law School graduate. He had been a clerk for the Supreme Court. He knew Rehnquist on a personal basis. And when I met with the Chief Justice, he was there, and my charge to him was, you meet the Chief Justice every day, make sure he knows what's going to be going on, make sure he has whatever he needs, whether it's coffee or cookies, and let's make sure we have a comfortable relationship with him and he with us. And Ziegler did a wonderful job. And the Chief Justice, I mean, he handled a delicate process quite admirably. And I hope that, and I expect that Chief Justice Roberts will emulate that.
It is interesting, this question of a tie-breaking vote, though, because the obvious big vote that we can anticipate that would likely happen would be the vote on whether or not to call witnesses, which it looks like would probably happen after the arguments from each side. And I look at the Senate configuration now, and I see, you know, obviously you need four, you need 51 votes to pass that, and I see you have 46.
Well,
47 Democrats.
Let me just say, again, I don't think that the leadership would let it come to that. I certainly wouldn't. Yeah. If I were the majority leader and saw that coming, I would switch my own vote if I had to. You know, that you don't want to put the Chief Justice in that position, because it could be a vote on something that he might have to, you know, deal with.
Yeah.
On the Supreme Court.
And how do you think that – you think there will be witnesses? Do you think, like, you know, John Bolton has said that he would testify if he were subpoenaed?
Well, you know, the president has every right, in my opinion, to, you know, exert executive privilege for his close advisors. The problem is if that occurs, the only way that can be rectified is the third branch of government, which is through the court system, which could take a long time. And I guess that's why they didn't call some of the witnesses in the House. The answer to your question is, yeah, I think they probably will have a few witnesses. Remember, we had a second vote, how we set it up. We did have depositions that were videotaped and recorded and then transcribed where senators could view it or read it, of three witnesses. But I resisted passionately bringing in President Clinton to the floor of the Senate or Monica Lewinsky. I thought it would be demeaning for the office and for the chamber. And I resisted that aggressively because I just didn't think that you know that was appropriate, and that we should go that far in trying to make a decision. We did, though. You know, we did take the deposition of Monica Lewinsky and two others,
Sidney Blumenthal,
and everybody
Betty
seemed to be comfortable with how that played out.
Yeah. Well, Senator Lott, I appreciate you sharing with us your recollections and your thoughts on this next trial. I have to say. Did as a then younger reporter covering every step of it. One thing that stands out to me is that both you and Senator Daschle were also very open with the press. I think that there was, you know, there was a degree of transparency and access.
Right.
Obviously,
right.
You went into the old Senate chamber behind closed doors, which was appropriate to. Come up with your agreement and start, and also obviously the deliberations in the end. But I do. Those are very memorable days for me. And I remember, you know, you were in the middle of it all and dealt with us. I know there are some issues now that you've got nothing to do with that are a little concerning about just how open the press coverage will be of this trial. But with you, I kind of fondly remember those days. They were exhausting.
Well,
they were fascinating.
Very much, John,
they were historic. But.
It was, frankly, when I look back on my career in Congress, it was one of the two things that I thought that overall we did the best job with, and I felt like the American people agreed. And I must say, what really mattered was we came out of that, which could, you know, wasn't easy and could be acrimonious, and went back to work, getting the work of the people done. They need to do that now.
All right. Senator Trent Lott, thank you very much for joining us on Powerhouse Politics. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. That is all the time we have for Powerhouse Politics. Thank you to our entire Powerhouse Politics team. And on behalf of Rick Klein, special thank you for Avery Miller and Trevor Hastings and our entire production team. We will see you next week.